Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Michelle Sherman. Michelle Sherman, PhD, is a clinical psychologist who has dedicated her 30-plus year career to supporting families dealing with a mental illness or history of trauma. She was named the American Psychological Association's Family Psychologist of the Year in 2022. Michelle has served as a therapist for over 30 years, providing individual and couple psychotherapy to adults in a VA medical center, urban primary care clinic, community clinic, inpatient psychiatric unit, and private practice. As an educator, she served as a full professor at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center and the University of Minnesota Medical School, teaching and supervising trainees from numerous disciplines. She enjoys public speaking, having given over 250 workshops nationally and internationally. She conducts research and serves as the editor-in-chief of the journal Couples and Family Psychology, Research and Practice. She has published over 75 articles in peer-reviewed journals, over 80 book chapters and articles in other sources, and 4 books for the lay public. She also enjoys volunteering, having served on the board of the Oklahoma National Alliance on Mental Illness for 14 years, and currently volunteering with the Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness affiliate. She served as a disaster mental health volunteer with the American Red Cross and Salvation Army for many years. She is a volunteer choreographer with Open Door Community Theater. Grounded in the research she conducted while at the University of Minnesota, she also volunteers as a behavioral health consultant with professional and community theater companies as they provide musicals with psychological themes, thereby merging her love of psychology and theater. And with that, Michelle, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thanks for such a lovely introduction, Dave. I really am happy to be here. I've been looking forward to having a discussion with you today.
Yes, and we can thank your book publicist, Camille Sardina, for getting back to us. And I know there's a side story with me and Camille, which just proves the power of serendipity and that the people that come into our lives do not come into our lives just by pure chance. Camille, I worked with Camille's great uncle in the Oneida County Probation Department when I first started out.
And
she's got connections here in the upstate New York area. So I told her, if she ever gets to upstate New York to look me up, I'd love to meet her.
Oh, what a small world. She's a delight. Yes, it's lovely that the two of you are able to find that common history.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And it's as the older I get, the smaller my world gets.
Yeah, I hear you. And actually, another connection, my father grew up in upstate New York, Buffalo sort of area. So I know that area and so many connections.
Yes, and I think we were all through the grand design, all meant to connect.
Absolutely. Me too, Dave.
So with that, my first question for you is, tell our audience about the professional experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
Yeah. You know, I started as a math major in college, and I got to the point of linear algebra, and I'm like, okay, I can't, my mind doesn't do this. I don't understand. And it wasn't really feeling like I was using my gifts, my skills, having a sense of meaning and purpose. And so I switched to psychology and have kind of never gone back, and have really been blessed by, as you kind of shared in my bio that was so kind, a lot of different opportunities to serve, to collaborate, to learn, to teach, to connect with colleagues, students, clients in a variety of settings. as you mentioned, part of my huge passion has been and continues to be kind of area in which we really look at the ripple effects of mental illness and trauma on families. And there's kind of a little story, actually, that answers how I got interested in that. And that literally in the mid-1990s, I know I'm dating myself here, Dave, but I was working in the VA hospital in Oklahoma City at that time and was just struck by so many of these family members who come in, you know, to the clinic. They're a veteran as a VA, would go into the doctor appointment, maybe short 5-10 minutes, maybe a therapy session, come out, and then they'd leave. You know, occasionally the family member would go in, but actually more often not. And I'm like, oh, wow, we've got all these people together with a great commonality of need, often feeling alone, confused, angry, sad, so many different emotions. I'm like, who is helping them? And so I wrote my very first, very small grant, $3,000 in the mid-1990s. And that's where it all began, honestly, is really starting to think about how can we create curriculum. And so that's what I did, is I created family education resources, therapy curriculum that therapists across the country could use. It was actually rolled out in the VA system. And that's where it all started, actually. And I was able to then evolve and serve families in a variety of capacities. Certainly individual therapy, couples therapy, some family therapy. One of my favorite things, Dave, was doing multiple family groups, which I'd never done before, but we used Dr. Bill McFarland's MFG, multiple family group model. It was one of my coolest experiences in my whole professional life. I did it with a retired colonel psychologist colleague, and wow, it was the veteran with the mental illness or the trauma and their family member, parent, partner, sibling, AA person, chaplain, whatever. They'd come in for an X number of psychoeducational classes, then we'd do breakouts and come back together. It was powerful, Dave. It was so cool. It was a very formative experience in my career. These professional experiences paired with my personal life experiences. Certainly, I have numerous family members who experience or have experienced mental illness, and that has absolutely driven, sustained my passion for this area. It's really a combination of personal and professional experiences.
And I like the fact that your first focus was on curriculum, because I think as therapists, one of the things that I think is so key, you know, as part of establishing a rapport with the client is doing education with them in terms of what dysfunctional family dynamics looks like, what their mental health diagnosis looks like. When I was a therapist, Michelle, if I had a nickel for every client that didn't know what their diagnosis meant, I'd be a rich person. So the first and foremost is education. And I think with education becomes empowerment for individuals to act on those tools to change their behavior. So,
and for families, you know, to help them understand, not to stigmatize or pathology, but what is this? What are these symptoms? What are treatments? There's so much psychoeducation. I believe firmly in that. I would say necessary, but not sufficient. You know, that's not enough, but I fully agree. And that's where the whole start of it began, was the SAFE program, Supported Family Education, was a 18-session curriculum that any therapist could pull off the internet, just go and do, and really got to start with bringing people together. This was pre-COVID, obviously.
Yeah.
Bringing people physically together and the power, you know, as a therapist, the power of people being in the same room. It's pretty intense, pretty awesome.
Well, particularly when they're bonded around very like problems, very similar problems. That type of support is powerful.
Absolutely. And this was the veteran community. So there's some already camaraderie and connectivity, you know, among that. And then, yeah, people who live in rural areas or some of these illnesses, I mean, let's face it, they're confusing. Schizophrenia, bipolar, I mean, all of them can be. But to be able to sit across the room or across the table from someone who's having some similar experiences can be amazingly powerful. And they would often exchange phone numbers on their own and connect and build friendships. So it was powerful step. So those were some of my, I think, formative experiences.
And, you know, also from my experience, without proper diagnostic tools, schizophrenia can be misdiagnosed. Bipolar disorder can be misdiagnosed.
Absolutely. And people diagnose themselves, right?
Yeah.
Or with insufficient training, or we have misinformation online. I mean, all sorts of things. Absolutely. And we know with many, I'd say maybe all mental illnesses, earlier detection really bodes for a better course. And so, I mean, obviously the huge movement of first episode psychosis programs, which I find very exciting. Sadly, the percentage of people who actually can access them for lots of reasons, it's relatively low, sadly, but the ability to intervene early and do that wraparound care is powerful. So absolutely early intervention.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I know you've written 4 books, and really what I want to focus on is a recent one that you co-authored with your mom, Deanne Sherman. It was titled Loving Someone with a Mental Illness or History of Trauma. Tell our listeners what inspired you and your mother to write this book, what it's about, and what you want readers to take away from it.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dave. After having written the other books for teenagers, I was actually at my nephew's soccer tournament at the beginning of COVID. I said to my mom, hey, after reading these other ones, hey, do you want to write a book?
Yeah.
And she said, yes. Her honest response today was, yes, anything with you, darling, which is so sweet. It's a motherly sort of response. And so that's where it began. And because most people, let's face it, will never go to a NAMI, you know, the National Alliance of Mental Illness. They'll never go to a NAMI support group. Most people never go to therapy, and most people don't need therapy, you know, won't go to couples therapy or perhaps not go to their loved one's psychiatry appointment or things. Talk about geographic. Maybe the nearest support group or whatever is 200 miles away. Maybe I'm working 2 jobs. I don't have the time. Maybe I don't have childcare. Maybe the expense. Maybe culture. I don't feel like they understand me. I mean, the list goes on and on. So I wanted to kind of put what I've learned from families for these 30 years in a book. So it's not only information, it's actually quite a small part of it, because you can Google, you know, what are the symptoms of schizophrenia or what are the symptoms of bipolar? I didn't want to do that. And so what we did was actually made it very skill-based. So what did I learn from 30 years that family members need? And I tried to put that in an interactive form so it's not dense. Most pages have pictures and activities. And then we know so well the power of reflection and writing and things of that nature. And so there are many opportunities for them to write about their feelings or thoughts or reactions for these family members. And then we interviewed and had people share their stories of people with lived experience as family members. And they were so kind to give us permission, you know, anonymous, of course, to share some of their stories. And so throughout the book, it's not just me as an academic or my mom as an advocate, but people who really have walked this challenging journey. And so it's also filled with stories. So our hope really is that people feel seen as loved ones. People feel kind of understood. And importantly, very importantly, those are good, but we also want people to feel empowered. What do I do in this situation? So we teach research-based skills, not just like kumbaya. I mean, kumbaya is good, but you know, what do I do? The book is not intended necessarily to read from cover to cover. You're like, okay, I'm struggling with how to set limits, how to deal with stigma, how to navigate the healthcare system, whatever else. It's like, if you're interested in this, go to this page. It'll give you kind of resources and activity. So we hope people feel empowered with skills and then absolutely knowing that they're not alone. There's clearly a resource list if they want to learn more and read more and things, but we hope they feel seen, validated, cared about, and empowered with skills.
Yeah, and I think the combination of books that have skill-based activities that individuals can use to give them the foundation to change or modify their behaviors, plus coupled with the individual stories, is a powerful combination, because individual stories need to be heard. And I think the biggest tragedy is a story that goes unheard.
I agree with you, Dave. I agree. So we really were intentional and grateful to the people who allowed us to use their stories and shared from their heart about their experiences. So yeah, that's the motivation for it, really, is really trying to make some of this experience and thoughts and wisdom and skills available to anyone on Amazon. You can hit the click the button and then you can have it. I mean, I had an email this morning from someone in South Africa saying, how do I get your book? It's like, what is Amazon? You know, we want to make it readily available to people.
Yeah, I'll make sure that the link to purchase your book is included in the episode notes so that people know how to get it.
They can actually order it anywhere, but our website, seedsofhopebooks.com, has sample chapters and things like that. So that would be a great place people could check out.
Yeah, and I've checked out the format of your book. I got the PDF version from Camille, and the book is just outlined just so nicely. You have specific skills, specific reflective questions, you talk about specific areas that are important to, you know, you talk about how to deal with anxiety, depression. There's a little bit for everybody in this book, and it's very easy to read, very easy to understand, and very easy to apply.
Oh, well, Dave, thanks for saying that. Was what we hoped.
Well, you're welcome. And if that's what you hoped, your hope manifested into reality, because it's a great book.
You're so kind. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Now, my next question is, what are some ways that individuals can support and stay connected to their loved ones with a mental health challenge?
Wow. Such a great question, dear. I guess I'll respond in two ways. One is, absolutely, what we know is that everyone, but we're talking right now about people with mental illness, need community, need people. We talk about the former Surgeon General saying, you know, one of the biggest kind of pandemics again in our society is loneliness. Social isolation is huge. We do know that people experiencing particularly serious mental illness are having pretty high rates of loneliness. So having them connected, knowing that you are there, knowing that you will advocate for them, helping them find ways of moving toward their goals, not necessarily your goals, but their goals, and helping them know that you're going to be their champion, you're going to be there. Not that there's not going to be conflict, frustration, disappointment, disagreement, et cetera, but they know that you're in their corner, that you're their teammate. It's huge. Navigating the mental health care system is hard to begin with, much less if you're struggling with mental illness at the time. So knowing someone that can help you, that they will love you, that they will be there unconditionally. However, of course, not including or condoning abuse of any kind. That's certainly not appropriate or accept. In my opinion, even the worst case of mental illness does not condone or make abuse okay in any way, shape, or form. Just that you'll be there for them. That is, I think, a huge way. And then being aware of, learning about community resources for them, such that if and when they may be ready or wanting to, you say, well, actually, a friend said this or whatever else. So helping them navigate, find resources can be helpful. The other thing I will say, equally importantly, in my opinion, is taking good care of yourself as a caregiver. It's so easy to get burned out and overwhelmed and struggle to set limits. And let's face it, if you don't take good care of yourself, you're not going to do a good job of taking care of them. Now, it's almost inevitable that families may feel some guilt. Well, crap, why can I go out when my husband is on the couch, or when my son is in a manic episode, or when my daughter's in the hospital, whatever else? Oh my gosh, why should I be having fun when they're struggling? And I understand that, and I appreciate and validate those feelings. And it is so important for you to take the time, the energy to nourish your own soul, your spirit. It doesn't have to be like a big trip to the Bahamas. You know, we can say go to a yoga class or go in the bathroom and just take a bath or just do some stretching or things. You know, it doesn't have to be big, but regular, consistent investment in your own well-being. Maybe your own therapy, maybe talking to a clergy or spiritual activities, maybe a NAMI group, I mean, a DBSA group. I mean, there are all sorts of opportunities. But one of the best ways to take care of your loved ones is to take care of yourself.
Yeah, if the gas tank is empty, right, you can't fill up anybody else's gas tank.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I fully agree. So that's why I kind of answered your question two ways. Both is like, yes, presence, advocacy, that love and being present, and also then setting limits and taking care of yourself. They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, I like the fact that you kind of see this as that we are kind of co-travelers on their path from mental illness to mental health. And we're going to walk the path with them. We're not going to walk it for them, obviously, but we're going to walk it with them. And we're going to provide whatever presence, whatever resources that they need to empower them to discover and develop longstanding mental health.
And recovery. You know, when we really talk about what recovery means, it doesn't necessarily mean not having symptoms, okay? But that I'm engaging in a life of purpose and meaning, and I have community and activity and belonging. This is what we all want. Serious mental illness are not, you know? Yeah. Yeah, goodness, you know, the statistics say about 1 in 4 of us have mental illness at any one point in time. Half of us will have a mental illness at some time in our lives. So this is not a rare thing. Now, of course, we're talking a little bit more about the more serious illnesses, but even so, the mental illness is on such a continuum. And so I think we all want those things.
You know, I think if we can help clients understand that being aware of their symptoms is a key to recovery.
Yeah.
you know, it's like with an individual who's addicted. If you don't talk about relapse right from the get-go, right, during their treatment program, you're doing them a disservice.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. This is part of the nature of the experience.
Yep.
Yeah. So education for both the individual with the illness and the family members is just key. I fully agree. So important. And I would add simultaneously, also when both the patient and the loved one instilling hope that, mm-hmm, yes, these are serious and significant illnesses and issues, and there's help. Just in the past, 2 months, we had a new schizophrenia medication come out, and some of the pretty significant barriers to another very popular medication for schizophrenia were just significantly reduced. So, I mean, there truly is reason to be hopeful that, mm-hmm, people can make positive changes and new medications and therapies. So absolutely acknowledging the illness and instilling hope.
I agree, because if we can instill hope or they don't see hope,
right,
they're not going to recover.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're all needing to. And let's face it, even in our country right now, there are a lot of challenges. There are a lot of people who are struggling with maintaining, mm-hmm, hope. And so sometimes that's hard for all of us, therapists included, when times are challenging at a lot of levels. And so, you know, being able to look for and hold on to that hope, even if it's very small, is really important.
And, you know, I think understanding our own challenges can make us be more compassionate presence to those individuals,
absolutely,
who are going through them.
Absolutely. Because we're humans too, right, Dave?
Mm-hmm.
We're absolutely humans as well. So absolutely.
Now, I know you've done extensive research in the field of mental health. What have been your most significant findings, and how can clinicians effectively utilize them to improve or augment their direct practice services to individuals with mental illness?
I've been blessed with opportunities to do quite a number of research in different sorts of areas. Honestly, as I was preparing for today and thinking about our conversation, the area that I think really to me has been pretty striking and pretty powerful is these multiple family groups I was mentioning. We actually did longitudinal research with both the veteran and the family member over actually a 9-month period to look at their symptoms, their relationship, their resilience, their empowerment, all sorts of things. And we found both for the veteran and the family member really significant improvements in lots of different domains. And so to me, looking at, again, certainly individual therapy or psychiatry or whatever is great. Certainly resources in which families or whatever come together and groups for the person with illness is great. But there's something really powerful about this kind of multiple family group sort of model. I'll tell you, just 2 days ago, I got home from an international trip. I was in London on vacation, actually, but had the distinct pleasure of meeting with a woman who's the head of a charity there called Our Time. They do multiple family groups. They've been doing it for years. And they bring in a parent and a child, in which the parent has a mental illness and the child is the one trying to understand and make sense of it. And what the CEO of Our Time was saying is, you know what, Michelle? So much of it is the power of bringing people together. Children see other children. Parents see other parents. They have the socializing, the play, the education sort of time. It's exactly what I was talking about with the multifamily groups of adults. The power of bringing not only the person with the illness, not only the person who's loving them, but them together in the same sort of activity is really profoundly powerful. And as I even reflected myself, one of my strongest professional experiences in my 30 career was doing this. Our data was really powerful. And I'll simultaneously admit that it's actually hard because it's resource intensive, it's challenges with billing and all sorts of things. I wish I could speak with more optimism that, you know, this model that we did has taken off and lots of people are doing it. They're not, because it takes a lot of resources and things to do it. But I hope as we think about our future and that there will continue to be really an opportunity to look at and think about and bringing families together. That's answer number one. Answer number two is an area I have extreme passion about. And that is, we had a 3-site study, 3 different VAs, in which we brought together veteran parents.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about their experience of parenting with PTSD. How do they talk to their kids? What are their kids' experiences? What are some of their veteran strengths and things like that as being a parent? It was so cool, Dave. It was really awesome to hear about them. And there has been some growth of late and the VA in terms of trying to have some support as for veteran parents. Because let's face it, for many people, parenting is a source of meaning, a purpose in life. You know, a reason to get out of bed is I want to take care of my kids. So some of those findings of what these veteran parents need, and it's not just veterans, of course, but that's where I did the research. How can we listen to, how can we support, how can we empower these parents such that we can support the kids? Because the research is super clear, right? That offspring, children of parents with mental illness are at many times higher risk. I was just looking at some stats the other day. I was looking at, like, if a parent has bipolar or a parent has depression, the lifetime prevalence of a child developing some form, not specifically those, but some form of mental illness is like 50%. Which is obviously much higher than the normal base rate. These kids are for our future people in the mental health clinic. So how can we intervene earlier? Which is, as you mentioned, the last three other books. The other book we just released the second edition of, like 2 months ago, it's called I'm Not Alone, A Teen's Guide to Living with a Parent Who Has a Mental Illness or History of Trauma. To our knowledge, it's really the only book available for these teenagers. And so we really are equally passionate about how can we listen to the parents, how can we listen to the children and create resources for them? Because you and I are just meeting this morning, I'll share with you something that just thrills me, Dave. Last night I got an email from some psychiatric nurses. They had gotten a hold of our book for teens. And, you know, Dave, I'll just be honest with you. Writing books is a heck of a lot of work. It's been 5 years of every night, every weekend. A lot of it is not fun. Certainly some of it is fun. Working with my mom has been a blessing, and we mutually support each other and have fun, but there's a lot of it that's just a hell of a lot of work. And you never know, Dave. You know, so these are going to help. So, you know, we think so. We've had, you know, hundreds of reviewers, and, you know, people wrote nice things about it. I mean, all that, but it's like, you know, really, at the end of the day, will this make a difference? So this email I got from this Iceland nurse just touched my heart, because she said she works in a psychiatric hospital, okay, and so they are now having once a month kind of family days in which the children come in for these sorts of things, which at least in the United States are fading, sadly, in terms of family involvement, but that's a whole nother discussion. But they're bringing these children in, and so they actually bought some of our copies of our book for teens, I'm Not Alone, and she said she gave one to this young person, and this young person smiled ear to ear, saying, I've been looking for this forever, I'm so happy. She said, there are no books like this. So it's like, yes, this is what we wanted. This is what we hope. And now again, this is someone way off in Iceland, and English is not even their native language. But it's like, there is a need. But we in the United States, this is an opinion statement, are so far behind. The UK, Canada, Australia, who've been working to support these children for many years with programs such as this Our Time, with Iceland, with the UK, again, I mean, the Australia has had Comic Caught Me stuff for a while. Canada has some lovely things. We in the United States, we don't do much of anything. I'm a huge fan of NAMI. I've been on the board and volunteer tons. But even NAMI's not too interested in the experience of these children, how to serve them, how to do prevention, how to do earlier intervention, which makes me very sad. And so that's been part of my 30-year passion as well, is how can we really deal with this gap between the adult mental health services over here, the kid mental health services over here. They don't talk to each other. If we could at least get the adult providers to even say, Dave, and I'm not joking here, really, but to consistently say, do you have children? How are your children doing? Who's supporting your children? If we made progress on that, Dave, that would be amazing. Truly, truly.
Well, you know, the thing is, and I mentioned this in, to my students in my impact of addiction on children and families class, is that particularly if you have generations of trauma that is due to either addiction, abuse, mental illness, there are a certain set of rules that are developed in order to maintain that dysfunction and maintain what is considered to be a quote-unquote healthy homeostasis in dysfunctional families. And if we don't do early intervention with teenagers or family members in the group to show them that, there are skills that you can develop that can help you shatter those rules or modify those rules so you can prevent that dysfunction from proliferating from generation to generation. Why not? Because, you know, if the rules don't change, the behaviors aren't going to change.
Absolutely.
And they're also going to align with individuals who know those same dysfunctional rules. And that's going to be proliferated across other generations of other families that become their acquired family. So to do that type of work and to have the type of book that you and your mom have about I'm Not Alone, A Teen's Guide to Living with an Individual with Mental Illness is so key because it breaks that cycle.
Exactly, Dave. Exactly. And so often these young people are invisible. No one's talking about them because let's face it. Okay, everyone's worried about mom who just had a psychotic break or attempt to harm herself. Dad and or the other mom, whatever, is worried and trying to get money and things like that. Who's even paying attention to the kids? And so giving the children information. And that one we do provide, certainly more psychoeducation. But what is schizophrenia? What is addiction? We do more there and also provide skills. But we have a whole chunk in that book, in the second edition of that book, I'm Not Alone, which is all about promoting resilience. Mm-hmm. Again, kind of a funny story. In the second edition, we had a lot of teenagers review that manuscript. Because a lot's changed in 20 years when we did the first edition of I'm Not Alone. Teenagers know a lot more about mental illness now, and they're more sophisticated, I think, about mental illness. So we had these reviewers, and one young person said, I need to know if my parent has mental illness, what can I do for myself? Now what? So we added a whole section, actually, on what does the research tell us about what can promote resilience, with the combination of nature and nurture, of course, both impacting and not being able to do a lot about the nature sort of thing. What are things that I can do? And interestingly, just around the past few years, there have been a number of studies that have come out that have actually been this longitudinal, finding following kids over time. There's one study that was super interesting that looked at children's performance on like sports activities. Like, you know, in school, you have to do like how many push-ups, sit-ups, stuff like that you can do. So they actually looked at that hard data. And they looked at mental health sort of stuff and lots of other variables, how much the kids were exercising, their diet, all this sort of stuff. And that's what we want, right? So if we can talk about, hey, kids, yeah, we know getting enough sleep and exercising and eating healthy, oh, that's nice. But actually, did you know that it can decrease your chance of even developing depression, anxiety, whatever else? And then if you do develop those, you'll be able to cope with it better. That's powerful. So that's why we have in the last part four of the book, specific, you know, motivational interviewing. We talk about science of health behavior change, of setting goals, having a buddy, all these sort of things to help them do that, but actually provide the rationale in terms of why. This isn't just like a book on why you should exercise, but I've got a parent with mental illness. I don't want to develop that sort of illness. What can I do? So that's some of the ideas in terms of why we added that whole section.
Yeah, and I get the sense that, you know, we talked about this. There's a gap in awareness of these at-risk youth. And the need to invest in prevention makes sense. You and your mother are very passionate about creating a voice for these invisible youth.
Yes.
And also for investing in prevention to intervene before problems can really get really impactful.
Now, we need to address the elephant in the living room to at least acknowledge it. I know we have about 10 minutes left, but there's an elephant in the living room here. And that is, there are two poles, right? I mean, there's the neglect, not paying attention to, not even aware, not talking about. On the other extreme here, they call the term presumptive neglect, meaning if I, as a doctor, come in and I, this mom, dad, whomever else, you know, has bipolar disorder, I assume they're not a good parent. I assume that they somehow are deficit. And the research is clear, really fascinating study that came out in 2019, comparing families in which a parent has a mental illness versus families in which there is not a parental mental illness, the risk of CPS, Child Protective Services involvement, is 8 times higher if there's parental mental illness. Now, I'm not saying that they don't have some increased struggles due to the nature of the illness. Yeah, of course, that makes sense. But are we doing some of this presumptive neglect or abuse and seeing them as bad parents? A lot of people with mental illness can be great parents. And we absolutely want to empower and support them. But we've got this elephant in the living room of fear of if I talk about, it's hard sometimes sitting on the floor and play Legos with my kid, or I sometimes yell at my 15-year-old who's being just a J-E-R-K, are you going to take my kids away? Are you going to report me? I mean, that's the huge issue that we have to at least name here. So how can we help parents feel supported and empowered? Of course, keeping children safe. Of course, obviously, that is paramount. But how can we build team alliance supporting them rather than a fear-based sort of intervention?
Well, and I think it starts with presumptive parental training workshops, because we're not born just being great parents.
Right, right.
And I think every prospective parent should take a behavioral parental training workshop to learn about how to set boundaries with kids, how not to yell at kids, how to have conversations, how to negotiate as they get older. I think that should be part of it. So
it's hard. Parenting, period, is hard. Really hard.
Absolutely. And the other thing is having good trained individuals across the spectrum in the foster care system and child protective services. And a lot of times, Michelle, and this is, again, my own opinion, working in a state and county environment, there were gaps. I mean, it was like you could get a really well-trained CPS worker and you get somebody who doesn't have that training. And it's not our staff that are our greatest asset. It's our best trained staff that are our greatest asset, because they will provide the services that are needed to individuals who are at risk and who also have mental illness as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course I sort of don't know all states, but I think many states struggle to recruit and keep CPS workers because of the huge caseloads. It's hard work. This is hard work. And so it's a multifactorial issue, of course, but an important one. I think it is relevant to this conversation.
Yeah, well, it's a system issue. And if the system's broken, we have to find a way to fix the system.
Exactly. So, but I also just do want to infuse a spirit of hope here that there are a few more people talking about it. There's an association in Florida called the American Association of Caregiving Youth. Have you heard of it?
No. Yeah, no, I haven't.
By Dr. Connie Sosowski. And they are wonderful, again, Boca Raton, a Florida sort of organization in which they are all focused on supporting what they call, young caregiving youth. That's not specific or exclusive to mental illness. It's all different kinds of parental struggles, dementia, physical health problems, all sorts of different things. And so I'm on their research committee. And so we're looking at ways of trying to raise awareness, trying to increase resources and things. So there's definitely some progress, some international collaboration happening, which is hopeful. We got a ways to go. Well, we got to keep working together.
I mean, I think there's an old Buddhist saying that a 1,000-mile journey starts with a single step.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's even conversations like this, Dave. I mean, this is why I'm just so grateful to have opportunities to have conversations with people like you and people that will listen like, I wonder maybe if even of our clinic and our intake form, how are we doing with talking about children? Or I was talking to another clinician the other day and they're like, it's interesting. In most intake forms, there's something about talk about your upbringing or talk about your parents or your family of origin. Are they still alive? What's your relationship with them? But do we have just as much emphasis on how's your relationship with your kid? Usually not. And why not? Even if we again lean into that sort of angle, thinking about how are your children doing? How are your children impacted? Just like that research I mentioned in the VA with veteran parents, they really want to be a good parent. And sometimes it's darn hard when they're struggling with anhedonia, lack of interest, or depression, or angry outbursts, or haunted by memories. So how can we support you in being the kind of parent you want to be?
Yeah. Or if they're experiencing flashbacks, that are cue-induced or through dreams, that's going to get in the way of parenting. So,
and the kids are scared. So how do we help children understand what's going on? How do we help the co-parent or parents or grandparents or girls know how to talk to kids? But let's face it, we adults sometimes struggle to talk about this. How do we expect them to know how to talk to kids? That's why we wrote this book, is it's also for the adults to read, to help them know how to have conversations with the kids.
And I think that your book is going to prove to be very impactful and very important to those individuals who choose to read it, whether they're clinicians, whether they're individuals struggling with a loved one that has mental illness. That book's going to have something for everybody, Michelle.
Well, thank you. We hope so. I mean, with mental illness being so common, how can we really continue to raise awareness and provide some information, skills, and hope? That's the name of our company, Dave, Seeds of Hope Books. We don't just walk around and say, life is great, life is wonderful. We say in kind, respectful, kid-friendly ways that, yes, your risk is higher because of this, and this is what you can do about it. But we're honest. We feel you have to be.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes honesty isn't the prescription that people want to hear, but it's something that's better than being disingenuous.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for such your affirming and kind words. It's really lovely.
Well, you're welcome. And my last question for you is if individuals want to purchase your books, find out more about Seeds of Hope, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, through our website, www.seedsofhopebooks.com. You can actually find some free resources. Like I want to tell you, the research study I just told you with the veteran parents, we actually created a free interactive resource, a parent's guide to how to talk to kids about PTSD. So you can download it. It's all free. It's interactive. Many of the ideas I've been talking about today about how to support children and parenting. So in addition to seeing sample chapters from our two books, you can see some lovely things people wrote, learn more about our backgrounds and things. Yeah, you can see some other free resources. So I'd want to mention that for sure. That's on the website as well.
And I'll make sure all of that gets into the episode notes for on both the audio platforms and also the YouTube version
Wonderful.
Of the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you. That's great.
Yep. You're welcome. Michelle, thank you so much for being just a wonderful guest contributor today. I truly enjoyed our conversation.
Oh, I did too, Dave. It was lovely. Thank you so much for your kindness, your respect, your reflective and interesting questions. And I so enjoyed being with you this morning. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.